Radio Ulster. John Bennett continues his With Bennett, meeting well-known names from the worlds of arts, sport and entertainment. This week he travels to London and chats with the Hollywood actor, Sam Neill.
Back in the 1950s, when the Neill family left Oma for a new life in New Zealand, they surely couldn't have dreamt that seven-year-old Nigel would overcome illness and a stutter to become one of Hollywood's most sought-after actors. On the big screen, he was to star in blockbusters like Jurassic Park and on television in the highly acclaimed BBC series Peaky Blinders. And along the way, Nigel became Sam Neill. When I met him in London, we talked about some of his major film roles, including his latest Hunt for the Wilder People, but also about his early days in Northern Ireland and how that speech disorder was never going to prevent him achieving his goal.
We had a house at Torella Beach for years, and those are my earliest memories, being very ill in an upstairs bedroom. And I was probably close to death because people were being very nice to me. That's how you know you're dying, I had an operation not so long ago. I thought, this is more serious than I've been told, because people are being so nice. As soon as, of course, when you come out of hospital, then they just go back to being normally unpleasant. But my mother always thought that my stutter was to do with the trauma of having whooping cough at the age of three. And As a child, especially in the company of adults, I hardly spoke at all. And with strangers, I would be in mortal terror that they might address me, because it would mean I would have to reply. And a reply to a well-meant question can be a source of much terror to a stutterer.
Did you have to have therapy, or did it naturally just leave you?
No, it sort of gradually left me in my teenage years. And that was something to do with perhaps getting more self-confidence. My youngest daughter, she was stuttering very badly at the age of three. She was like me. She could hardly speak, particularly if she was excited. She'd just keep going, like that. And someone suggested that we take her to a speech therapist, which we did. Now, one of the most surprising things in my life was the speech therapist said, "Have either of you two, the parents, ever stuttered?" And I said, "Well, I did when I was a child." And she said, "You know, very often this is an inherited condition, but we can fix it." So she had 6 months therapy, and now she talks far too much.
It's amazing, isn't it, that someone who has this disability goes on to become an actor whose stock in trade is having the ability to make the sound of a word on a cue.
Well, I know two actors, two very good and well-known actors, who are very bad stutterers. And as soon as they get on the stage, the stutter just evaporates. It's like it doesn't exist.
The film The King's Speech brought this problem to the forefront a few years ago, but if what I read is correct, Sam, you weren't entirely convinced by the veracity of the script and parts.
Well, they stressed that it was trauma, and it could have possibly been in his case, you know. Didn't they say that the king had been terribly bullied by his father or something, and that had caused the stutter? But I think there are many causes. If you have a stutter, you don't necessarily have to look at something awful that happened to you that you've forgotten, because it may not be trauma at all. It may be just something you've inherited. I mean, people have all kinds of things that happen to them, but I do encourage people to get help, to get therapy, to go to a good voice therapist. And if you have a child that has a stutter, get them to a voice therapist as soon as possible.
I'm struggling to find even a nuance of Ulster in your accent, Sam, but so far not successful. You've been away too long, perhaps.
I'm curious as to know what voice I had when I left Northern Ireland. There's no record of that.
You were only, what, seven, eight?
I was seven or eight, yeah. But I think one of the formative things about a lot of actors is that they moved around when they were children. And we were, uprooted from Northern Ireland when I was 7 years old and taken to as far away as you possibly could be to the other side of the world. And whatever accent I had to lose very, very quickly. And because you didn't... That's the thing about kids. They want to sound like everybody else. They want to fit in. They want to look like everybody else. And basically, they don't want to be bashed up in the playground. So you learn to be like everybody else. But also, the school playground is the genesis of actors. And a lot of actors that I know, their parents have been in the services, or they've been in the diplomatic corps, they've moved around as kids and they've had to adapt.
Our scheduled meeting is not until Sunday.
Sorry to bring it forward.
You just wanted to show me that you know where I live, isn't that it? Am I supposed to be impressed?
No. Mr. Churchill was impressed.
I'm slightly miffed that when you had to pick up a Belfast accent for Peaky Blinders for Chester Campbell, you went to a Ballymena man and a Coleraine man to learn a Belfast accent.
Well, I didn't. It wasn't clear that he was from Belfast, although he'd been seconded from a position in the police in Belfast. But I don't know where he was born in Northern Ireland. And one of the things that I had a couple of sessions with Liam and a couple with Jimmy.
It's Liam Neeson, Jimmy Nesbitt.
Yeah, a couple of Ulstermen. and they were both very helpful. And, of course, they've got entirely different accents, which was a comfort to me. So I thought, I'm not going to be... I wasn't burdened with being too incredibly specific about where I came from in Northern Ireland. I just had to give it enough Northern Irishness to get away with it elsewhere in the world. I'm sure there were people in Belfast whose facial expressions went to one of pain whenever I came on the screen, but a Northern Irish voice is so expressive. It was beautiful to work with.
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was quite a lot of hilarity at the meeting. The gentlemen all found it quite funny.
I see, the gentlemen found it funny. Tell me this, Mr. Campbell. Do the gentlemen sometimes find you funny?
We will discuss our business on Sunday, on the agreed day at the allotted time, and at the place that has already been determined.
You made your point. Good night, Mr. Shelby.
When you went to school in New Zealand, you lost your real name, didn't you?
Yes, well, that was another issue again. On my birth certificate, it says Nigel. Now, no one wants to be called Nigel.
Except Nigels.
except Nigel. It's a terrible disadvantage being a Nigel. And I wrote an article last year, or the year before, I think, you know, when UKIP was getting a lot of traction. I said, don't worry too much about Nigel Farage. He'll never be prime minister of any country, because with the name Nigel, there's a glass ceiling. You know, you can get so far and you won't go any further.
You're not a political animal at all, are you?
I am a bit, and I'm perplexed by this year. This has been the strangest year in living memory. Well, my living memory, anyway. What's happening politically around the world. And, of course, I'm not a little concerned about Northern Ireland. I don't know what Brexit means for Northern Ireland. I'm sad that you're going to see another border. It'll be the border between Europe and whatever is left here. I don't know.
The name James Mason comes into your story when you were still quite a young actor. How did that impact on your career?
It was one of those odd turning points. James and his wife had seen me in a movie, and he rang me out of the blue one day and said, my name is James Mason. We like your work, and I'm sending you an air ticket. We think you should come to Europe and work over here. I've got an agent for you. When you're free, come and stay with me and my wife, and we'll have a holiday. And I live near Geneva, and we'll send you on to England. And so that's why I ended up working here for 7 years or so.
But that's fairy godmother stuff, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't happen very often like that.
No, it's very unusual, and it was an enormous kindness, not just because he sort of physically got me out of where I was, but also it was just sort of it boosted my confidence. One of the things that is, I think it's fair to say about Australia, New Zealand really, is that it's not a particularly encouraging environment. No one ever says, you're a good actor, or you could go places. No one had ever said that to me before. So that was really the first time when I got to Australia, people were encouraging, and then I got a call from a famous actor who said, I believe in you. And that took me by surprise. So in terms of morale, that was priceless.
In terms of films, what would you consider was your big breakthrough?
I don't know what breakthroughs are, really. I mean, I've done films that have done better than others. They're not necessarily the ones I'm the most fond of. Some films have been absolute turkeys.
Was there one, though, after which the scripts started to come through your letterbox at an increasing rate?
I've never been flooded by scripts. But I suppose... I don't know, really.
Jurassic Park got an awful lot of publicity all over the world. And your name, obviously, was in the forefront of that. What was it like working with Mr. Spielberg?
Well, I liked Steven very much. He's extremely energetic and personable, and he sort of makes everything happen. I haven't seen him for quite some time, we're talking 20 years ago now, I suppose. Mm. Might be more.
But the impact of that film still reverberates, doesn't it?
Yes, there were a couple of caveats that went with that. I do remember a review that said, this film is a milestone in the history of cinema. For the first time, special effects are more convincing than the actors. So, you know, that was...
It's hard to know how to take that, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't take it very well, to be honest.
The sheer versatility, Sam, of your catalogue, though, would suggest that there is a bit of the chameleon in you when it comes to acting. Do you find it difficult to assume a new character, or do you have to work long and hard at it? For instance, a submarine officer in Red October.
Well, that submarine officer, who was a Russian, it was clear from day one that Sean was not going to change his accent.
Sean Connery.
Yeah, and I was told that we're all just going to use our own voices. I thought it was kind of absurd that, the second in command of a Russian submarine would sound like a New Zealander. So I did suggest a little bit of Russian in my voice, hoping I'd get away with it, but without the heads of the studio saying, that guy is... Get him off the set.
You should have come to Liam Neeson and Jimmy Nesbitt for coaching.
I don't think I did a lot of preparation for that. Sometimes, it's good to make up a little, imaginary history in your head about what's happened to this guy before he appears and then disappears in the film.
You wouldn't class yourself as a method actor, would you?
No, I do. I really rather... admire some of these people who stay in character all the way through lunch and stay that person for 12 months or whatever, however long it takes. But I think I'm far too relaxed for that.
So when you finish the shoot that day, you go home, have a pint, you're Sam Neill again. There's no blurring of the lines.
I hope so. I mean, when I'm playing, someone quite demonic like Chester Campbell in The Peaky Blinders, I'd hate to think that go back and that's a psychotic bully then goes back into the house torturing his children and things. No, I'd definitely not.
A couple of roles which you didn't take, starting with one which I believe you actually turned down, was Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which I thought was a wonderful movie, but You were offered the part, which Terence Stamp eventually took, I believe.
Yes. Actually, I think that's one of the few things I've turned down that I actually regret it. But I read the script and I didn't get it at all. And I had no qualms about playing a man in a frock. I'd do it tomorrow. In fact, I pretty much wore a frock in as Cardinal Wolsey in The Tudors, which we did in Ireland. Big red frock. But I just didn't. I didn't read it right. I didn't think it was funny, and I didn't really. I didn't get the tone of it. And then when I saw it, I thought, "This is terrific." You know, why didn't I do that?
The other one, which may not have been your decision, was the audition you did as James Bond. Are your memories of that particularly happy, or would you rather push that to the back?
No, it wasn't a part that I coveted at all, and I've never quite understood why there's such a you know, excitement, and I was at dinner last night, and people go, "Who's going to be the next James Bond?" I don't really care, you know. I'm always rather more interested in the villains in Bond. I quite like to be a Bond villain. They're much more interesting parts. I was bullied into doing a audition for Bond by a rather assertive agent that I had at the time. And it wasn't a very enjoyable day at all.
This was to replace Roger Moore, just to get it into context, was it?
Yes, I think that's about the point that Bond was at the moment. I don't really follow it all that closely. And to my relief, it was never offered to me anyway. So
I read that you refused to take your shirt off to display your physique, and that was one of the reasons why you weren't offered the part.
Yes, well, I'm not exactly Arnold Schwarzenegger in the pectoral department.
You're not just shy.
You just don't want to be. And I was a sort of skinny, weedy guy. You know, why do you want to be a skinny, weedy guy playing Bond? It's you want to be buff like Daniel Craig. You know, and I'm sure Sean Connery in his day was buffed.
But surely this time has come when a cerebral Bond could take over.
A cerebral Bond.
Somebody who does the Times crosswords, you know.
I think you're talking about an entirely different franchise. Something you might have to write yourself. The Cerebral Bond. Professor Bond.
Matt, where's our Matt?
Don't need one. I know where I am.
Probably couldn't even read it anyway.
Why would I need to read a map? I already told you I know where I am. Reading's stupid anyway.
Only people who can't read say things like that. What? No. You can't read?
What should
you're like one of those people who like race by like wolves or something, eh? Ooga booga, me hat, me no read. What's this? This is words, me stupid.
Hunt the Wilder People, it's a lovely film. I watched it just last night, and I thought to myself afterwards, that's a little film that really grew as I watched it. Was that the actor's point of view when they started the film?
I saw it described the other day as a little film with a big heart. Yeah, I think it's about big things as well. It's been described as a comedy very often, but I don't really see it as a comedy. I mean, abandoned children, foster children, that's a very serious business. And it's also about grief, loss, love, you know. But there's a lot of funny stuff in it. There's something very refreshing about Taika Waititi, the director who made this and wrote it. People say it's like nothing they've really quite seen before.
The director clearly loves New Zealand, his own country, because it's evident the love is in every shot. And the countryside really is the big star of this film, isn't it? Because the scenery is stunning.
No, I'm the big star of the film. And the scenery is an adornment to my own brilliance. Are we clear on this?
There speaks an Ulster man.
Yeah. Now, in fact, I would say that Julian Dennison, who plays the kid, is actually the star, to the extent that one of the producers the other day said, you know, there will be the New Zealand Film Awards. And I said, listen, Carthy, I want to be in the assistant actor category. I don't want to be in the lead actor category because I will be effortlessly beaten by a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, Uncle, we're famous! Hector Faulkner, 65. and Richard Baker, 13, have been missing now for 6 weeks. Faulkner is Caucasian. Well, they got that wrong because you're obviously white. There is a fear for Faulkner's mental health following the recent death of his wife. Police are not ruling out kidnapping. Kidnapping? Park rangers have been alerted for anyone seeing the pair should report back to the nearest police station. Oh, Uncle, you're basically a criminal now. But on the bright side, you're famous.
They think I'm crazy.
And Asian.
You know, we spent quite a few weeks, just the two of us, working together, and we got to know each other very well. I got to like him very much. He's a great kid and very, very funny. In fact, the burden of being funny was much more his than mine. I laughed with him, at him, along with him all day.
So what do we do now?
We run. No, we don't need to run.
Huh? Oh, yeah, this is fast walk.
Gonna be rough. No huts, no tents, real bush life. And if you play up, I'd dump you.
Okay, Uncle.
I'd still prefer if you don't call me Uncle.
Does it often happen that bonding on stage or on screen carries over behind the scenes? Like, evidently it has here.
Well, this is unusual in that we're, you know, I'm about 150 years older than him. Mostly people are, well, these days they're about half my age, if not a third my age. But, look, I find actors generally very good company. They're amusing. And I make a point, when I go to somewhere like South Africa or, you know, I'll be somewhere like Romania or places you don't expect, and you're sort of shoved into each other's company, I do my best to make that company a company and that we enjoy each other's company and have a good time. Life's too short to be travelling around the world doing jobs and being miserable about it.
Never stop running.
Yeah, and I'll never stop chasing you. I'm relentless. I'm like the Terminator.
I'm more like Terminator than you.
I said it first, you're more like Sarah Connor. In the first movie too, before she could do chin-ups.
The critical acclaim all over the world has been amazing in this, and it will, I'm sure you'll agree, will help to put New Zealand film on the map, because up until now it hasn't really been foremost in that direction, has it?
Well, we're a little country. I mean, there's only 3 or 4 million of us. So we can't be expected to make an awful lot of films. And a lot of that film energy, of course, has been focused in and around Peter Jackson, who made all the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings films there, of course. So we do make films, but we don't make a lot of specifically New Zealand films, just because we don't have the money as much as anything. So having said that, this is the most successful New Zealand film at home to date. I think we made it for $2 million or something like that. We shot it in 25 days, and it made $12 million at home, which is big for us.
Tell me about your vineyard. They do say you do a passable Pinot Noir.
Yeah. I've been growing wine since 1993, so it's 25 years now almost, and it gives me great pride.
It sounds almost that there's a therapeutic aspect to growing grapes for wine.
Yes, but it's not just the making the wine, because I also have animals, I have pigs and sheep, and everything's organic. We use certain biodynamic principles involved. So we go around with a kind of slightly smug self, an air of the virtuous about us, because I think we produce healthy wines, and we're healthy on our property. You know, we're not spraying things with chemicals that do horrible things to other forms of life. And we're great believers in the health of soil. I was reading a Seamus Heaney poem yesterday. I think it's called Following. It's about his father ploughing. And it has all that, you know, how important soil is. It describes the, you know, following his father and the soil turning and tripping behind. And it has that heartbreaking end to it, where now his father's following him and won't go away.
Roll the verse.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a beautiful poem. My father worked with a horse plow. His shoulders globed like a full sail strung between the shafts and the furrow. The horse strained at its clicking tongue. An expert, he would set the wing and fit the bright steel pointed sock. The sod rolled over without breaking. At the head rig, with a single pluck of reins, the sweating team turned around and back into the land.
His eye narrowed and angled at the ground, mapping the furrow exactly. I stumbled in his hobnailed wake, fell sometimes on the polished sod. Sometimes he rode me on his back, dipping and rising to his plod. I wanted to grow up and plough, to close one eye, stiffen my arm. All I ever did was follow in his broad shadow round the farm. I was a nuisance, tripping, falling, yapping always. But today, it is my father who keeps stumbling behind me
and will not go away. Jesus. Makes you cry. I love empty places, you know. I love a beach where you can see three people in the distance, and there are wonderful beaches and headlands and things in Northern Ireland. So last time I was there, I was having lunch beside Belfast Lock, and I could picture that sailing ship that left Belfast in 1859 with my great-grandfather and his two brothers on board. And to the best of my knowledge, he never returned. You know, he died in 1834, at a very old age. But he left Northern Ireland at the age of 19, and it must have been like going to the moon, you know. But I often think about that sort of separation and how, you know, and I asked my aunt before she died, what kind of accent did my great-grandfather have? Because she knew him. She said, well, he had an Ulster accent. Very mild, she said. But his grandfather was a man called John Neal, and I've been to his grave. It's in a little place called Seaford in County Down. There were so many records that were demolished and lost in Ireland, and he's the last one. We can't seem to get beyond John Neal. I think born in 1757 or something like that in Seaford and County Down. So if anyone can help going past John Neal, I'd be very grateful.
Sam Neal, it's been my pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.